This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Walt Whitman's Divided America. If you think things are crazy in our country now, consider Walt Whitman and his era. Whitman self-published the first edition of Leaves of Grass in 1855. The United States was then a young, optimistic country, in spite of the wrenching political schism over slavery. 6 years later, Whitman watched as his beloved nation split into two and Americans started to slaughter each other by the tens of thousands. Throughout it all, he never lost hope in America. He was its greatest booster and one of its most trenchant critics. If you haven't read much Whitman, I encourage you to dive in. A good way to start is Walt Whitman 101, one of the articles on major poets for students and teachers in the Learning Lab of the Poetry Foundation's website. Walt Whitman 101 was written by Benjamin Voigt, a visiting assistant professor of English at McAllister College in St. Paul. He joins me from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Ben, it's hard for me to think of another poet who resonates more with our situation in 2017. You may or may not agree, but I want to hear you make the case. Why should people read Walt Whitman now? What are they going to get out of him?
I think people should read Walt Whitman right now because he reminds us of sort of our highest principles as Americans, the thing that America can achieve, sort of a certain kind of largeness of spirit.
And an optimism. He was writing in terribly difficult times, yet he maintained a great optimism about American possibilities.
Yeah, I think that he's difficult to read now in some ways, in the immediate sort of aftermath of Donald Trump's ascension to the presidency and his inauguration and these policies that are being passed or sort of levied on the American public. It's hard to kind of have the magnanimous sort of ever-encompassing larger sort of persona of Whitman right now. It's hard to have his sort of optimism, his embrace of everything about America, his, you know, famous poem Song of Myself and his like ever-enlarging book Leaves of Grass. The first verse that he wrote of that, the first thing that he wrote kind of trying it on in his notebook was, "I am the poet of the slave and of the masters of the slaves," which sort of encompasses the, you know, huge schism of his time. And is also just like a hard pill to swallow in some ways. It kind of, I think what's most interesting to me about Whitman is he reminds us just how radical an idea democracy is.
Tell us a little bit about Song of the Open Road, which you cite in your Walt Whitman 101. By the way, it's also, it was a huge hit with the Beats and Jack Kerouac and his novel On the Road. I think it derives directly from some of the spirit of this poem. Tell us why it appeals to you, this poem.
I think it's an interesting figure, especially right now when we're thinking a lot about travel in the United States in the kind of immediate aftermath of this executive order banning immigration from certain countries. It's an interesting figure for his sort of grand idea of openness, of accepting all, of this sort of romantic ideal of coming to your own conclusions, essentially.
Would you do me a favor and just read the opening? This is a very long poem. There's no way we could read the whole thing for the podcast, but there's some beautiful sections in it, and I wonder if you could read just the first part of it.
Sure. Song of the Open Road. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road. Healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me leading wherever I choose. Henceforth, I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth, I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Done with indoor complaints, libraries, querulous criticism, strong and content, I travel the open road. The earth, that is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them. Still here, I carry my old delicious burdens. I carry them, men and women. I carry them with me wherever I go. I swear it is impossible for me to get rid of them. I am filled with them, and I will fill them in return.
Yeah, I love that. Even his burdens are a pleasure to him.
Even my old delicious burdens, yeah. He says.
But this is has a jaunty, almost arrogant optimism about it.
Yeah, I was thinking when we were talking about what poems to choose, which ones serve as a sort of introduction to Whitman and to speak to our political moment, of the sort of brashness of some of the lines in this poem. that almost sound like Trumpian.
I know. I was going to say that too, but I didn't want to. I'm glad you said it. But go ahead, explain what you mean.
I myself am good fortune, he says, right?
Yes.
As it, you know, like I, let me be honest with you, he says at another point in the poem, right? And I think that's an important quality of Whitman. He's been used in all sorts of ways. His sort of high public rhetoric gets appropriated by all sorts of people, including some, I think, who probably misunderstand him or, you know, are putting him to sort of strange, dubious ends, like, you know, using him in advertisements or whatever.
Yeah.
That his rhetoric can be, you know, if excerpted, if sort of excised from the sort of overall spirit of him, which I think is still quite radical in its sort of general idea, can sound very populist or nativist or something like that.
Well, he's got that in him. He certainly does. Mm-hmm. And he can seem to a lot of people, he can turn people off, actually, because he sometimes seems egomaniacal. But I think it's a misreading of what the I is in a lot of these poems. That I is not the personal Walter Whitman that grew up in Brooklyn. It's something embodying the whole country.
Mm-hmm. Especially in Song of Myself, where I feel like he sort of spirals outwards to like increasingly broad persona in that poem. There's a part where he says, I, Walt Whitman, age 35 or 36 or whatever it is, mm-hmm. begin this poem. So he is identifying himself in that way, but as this, you know, the individual personage. But, you know, later on in the poem, he says, you know, I am the man, I was there, I suffered, kind of identifying with the slave at one point. I am the hounded slave, identifying with these people killed in battle. I standing on the prairie witnessing a marriage between a trapper and a native person. He's kind of channeling something, yeah. Populous.
Yeah, I think that's the right word, channeling. He's trying to bring in all sorts of different voices into his own poetic eye and speaking for them. And it's just beautiful when it works well, when he's really on it, and when he writes about a runaway slave. Let me just play you something. Let's just skip to an entirely different poem, and I'm going to play a bit from Song of Myself. I once recorded Paul Giamatti reading this section about a runaway slave for a documentary I produced many years ago.
The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen, I saw him limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log, and let him in, and assured him, and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next to me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner.
That was Paul Giamatti reading a section from Song of Myself, the 1855 version. So Whitman tried to embrace every American of every stripe in his poetry, not only slaves, but the masters of slaves, as you said earlier. And that's what's so heartening about reading him. And that's what, to me, is so tonic about reading him today, is he's really trying, in a time of extraordinary divisiveness, to see everybody as part of the American project.
Yeah, and that's an incredibly difficult thing to do, I think, in a very divided moment, but also such a valuable one, such a, like a tonic one, as you say.
Yeah.
How can I, as a person, sort of meet my neighbors, encounter them in a real way rather than just sort of, you know, stand back from them and criticize them? How can I merge with them, as sort of the word that he loves and repeats so many times?
Yeah.
How can I find a sort of comradeship with them or an adhesiveness sort of with them, as he says?
Yeah, he wants to rub up against everybody and to get mm-hmm. to know them and talk to them and breathe them in almost. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's notably based in sort of bodily experience too. And this is another thing that I think makes him such a radical poet, is that his sort of worldview in a certain way, despite it being very sort of ideological in a sense, that he's like interested in sort of national politics. It's all grounded in just the body. It starts from the body. It starts from touch. It starts from the perfumes, as he says in the first section of Song of Myself.
Yeah, you know, it just gives me a little chill to think about how bodily life was in the 19th century, as opposed to us all sitting around in front of our computers on social media and kind of disembodied from each other and not having that physical contact that seemed to be very much part of the life that he knew in the 19th century.
And he seems to believe that that physical contact is important to this sort of the national unity that he desires. You know, he advocates for literature as a sort of tonic to sort of schisms in American politics, but he's always returning to kind of like his hands, right, his feet.
Yeah, and some of the most beautiful sexualized poetry I've ever read in my life, his descriptions of physical contact and, and the joy of physical contact and desire. It's just absolutely extraordinary when you encounter it for the first time, which I hope people do if they haven't. Let's go back to Song of the Open Road. Is there a later section of that poem you want to read?
Yeah, let's look at the second to last section, which is 14, where he kind of gets into this sort of sense of struggle, the challenge of the sort of openness that he's advocating for.
And I love how he begins, allons, with French.
Yeah, he begins with, he's taking on the, you know, the language of the immigrant in some ways, right?
Right.
Allons, through struggles and wars, the goal that was named cannot be countermanded. Have the past struggles succeeded? What has succeeded? Yourself, your nation, nature? Now understand me well. It is provided in the essence of things that from any fruition of success, no matter what, shall come forth something to make a greater struggle necessary. My call is the call of battle. I nourish active rebellion. He going with me must go well armed. He going with me goes often with spare diet, poverty, angry enemies, desertions.
So what's he up to here? What is he? He's asking for Americans to join him on the open road for what exactly? What is he up? What is his project in this poem?
I mean, the road he sort of figures as endless several times. And here we see that sort of figured in terms of struggle, right? The sort of forward movement, I think, is the promise of democracy rather than the kind of momentariness of it is always sort of what he's after and sort of what I see here.
And you know who that reminds me of is Barack Obama.
Of course, the answer to the slavery question was already embedded within our Constitution. A Constitution that had at its very core the ideal of equal citizenship under the law. A Constitution that promised its people liberty and justice and a union that could be and should be perfected over time.
Do you see a relationship between Obama's rhetoric and Walt Whitman's?
Absolutely. I see Obama in a certain way as a Whitmanic figure. He talks Whitman so much in the introduction to Leaves of Grass, the 1855 edition, his own sort of preface to his work about what the poet must be. And one of the things he says at the very end of that is that the great individual and the great poet sort of takes on the qualities that make a nation great. And I feel like often Obama was trying to do that, that as a person and as a public figure, he tried to embody what he saw as great about America, sort of the hope, the optimism, hope, change, yes, we can, that kind of attitude, but also the sort of willingness to compromise, to try to find common ground in unity.
Yeah, and both Whitman and Obama had a bit of a messianic complex, actually, in that they saw the unity as forming almost in them. Whitman in his personhood and in the inflated eye of his poems, and Obama in his personal story thought that he could heal American divisions by the power of who he was in some sense.
Yeah, and in Democratic Vistas, that late essay by Whitman, he's, you know, again, for sort of literature to heal us, kind of implicitly labeling his own project. And, you know, that introduction in the 1855 edition ends with him providing a benchmark for his own success, which is that the nation will absorb him. And I think to a certain extent, he succeeded in that, even if he didn't necessarily see it in his lifetime, that his voice, his free verse line is everywhere, and not only in an American poetry, but in kind of world poetry.
Ben, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Benjamin Voigt wrote Walt Whitman 101, A Great Way into This Very Great Poet. It's in the Learning Lab section on the Poetry Foundation's website. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can link to the podcast on social media from SoundCloud, or you can subscribe to it on iTunes. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.